International News.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. The Ukrainian government, along with various volunteer organizations, evacuated some elderly from Kherson Sunday. This happened amid intensified Russian bombardments, a harsh winter, and no electricity, water, or heating. Russian forces struck eastern and southern Ukraine early Sunday as utility crews scrambled to restore power, water, and heating with the onset of snow and frigid temperatures. Civilians continue to leave the southern city of Kherson because of the devastation wreaked by recent attacks and fears of more ahead. Beijing protesters held a peaceful demonstration Sunday evening for a third day over China's strict antivirus measures. The protests began Friday and have spread to at least eight Chinese cities, including Shanghai. The protests are the most widespread show of opposition to the ruling party in decades. Reuters correspondent Matthew LaRotonda has more.
The rare protests erupting in Chinese cities and universities are seeing protesters turn to an unusual symbol of defiance, holding up blank sheets of paper. Why? Because the bits of paper are as much a symbol as it's also a tactic to avoid arrest or running foul of the country's censorship laws. In Hong Kong 2 years ago, protesters also used blank paper as a response to the city's ban on certain protest slogans, and the tactic has recently spread to Moscow in protests against the war in Ukraine.
For more on these and other stories that we're following, please visit voanews.com. This is VOA News. A landslide during a funeral ceremony in Cameroon's capital Sunday has left at least 14 people dead, the regional governor said. Dozens of others remain missing as rescue crews continue digging through the rubble with flashlights. The regional governor told journalists the search for survivors was continuing into the night. The niece of Iran's supreme leader, a well-known rights activist, has called on foreign governments to cut all ties with Tehran over its violent crackdown on popular unrest kindled by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini. A video statement by her was being widely shared online after what activist news agency HRANA said was her arrest November 23rd. 22-year-old Amini's death while in police custody sparked protests that posed one of the strongest challenges to the country's clerical establishment since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. A legal advisor of the Iranian Football Federation says his country will sue the United States over their scrubbing of the Islamic Republic emblem from its flag on social media post. Mimi Montgomery for the AP has more on the U.S. protest.
The Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts of the U.S. men's team briefly displayed Iran's flag on social media, only bearing its green, white, and red colors, but without the emblem of the Islamic Republic. In a statement, the Federation says it scrubbed the official flag to show support for women in Iran fighting for basic human rights. The Iranian government reacted by accusing America of removing the name of God from their national flag. The move adds yet another political firestorm to this year's World Cup and comes as the U.S. faces Iran in a decisive match on Tuesday. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani announced in Baghdad Sunday the recovery of the equivalent of just more than $125 million U.S. The first part of an embezzled nearly $1.2 billion U.S. dollars. Auditors in Iraq uncovered the massive plan in which a network of businesses and officials embezzled some $2.5 billion from the country's tax authority. Brexit has compounded a doctor shortage in Britain, with an estimated shortfall of 4,000 in major specialty areas from EU countries, a study published Sunday said. It comes as the crisis hit NHS state-funded health service struggles after years of underfinancing, with record waiting lists for some hospital care. Musician John Batiste is on tap to perform at U.S. President Joe Biden's first White House state dinner on Thursday. It will be in honor of French President Emmanuel Macron. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Sunday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian forces dig in near Kherson in Ukraine.
The attacks happened as utility crews continue to scramble to restore power, water, and heating.
And protests continue in China over COVID restrictions.
Xinjiang is under some of the country's longest lockdowns. Many of Urumqi's 4 million residents are barred from leaving their homes for as long as 100 days.
We hear the latest on the World Cup from Qatar. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition, so stay tuned. In the Chinese city of Shanghai, protesters were on the streets Sunday morning chanting, "Communist Party of China, step down," and calling for China's President Xi Jinping to resign. The protest is part of nationwide rallies expressing anger at the government's harsh zero COVID lockdowns, as reported infections nationwide set daily records. For more on the origins of the protests, we have Olivia Chan of Reuters News.
Lift COVID lockdown is what this crowd in China's far western Xinjiang region is chanting after a deadly fire in a high-rise building triggered rare protests over the country's prolonged COVID lockdown. Videos circulating on Chinese social media show residents in the region's capital, Urumqi, arguing with guards in hazmat suits. And it comes as China's government grapples with widespread confusion and uncertainty in its big cities over the virus. China defends President Xi Jinping's signature zero-COVID policy as life-saving and necessary. The country recently tweaked its measures, shortening quarantines and taking other targeted steps. But cases have been rising. Xinjiang is under some of the country's longest lockdowns. Many of Urumqi's 4 million residents are barred from leaving their homes for as long as 100 days. The protests followed the fire, which killed 10 people on Thursday night. Authorities have said the building's residents had been able to go downstairs, but videos shared on social media led many to believe that residents could not escape in time because the building was partially locked down. Urumqi officials denied that COVID measures had hampered escape and rescue, but said they would investigate further.
That was Reuters reporter Olivia Chan. Officials say shelling by Russian forces has hit several areas in eastern and southern Ukraine overnight as utility crews scramble to restore power, water and heating from widespread strikes. State Power Grid Ukrainergo said electricity producers are now supplying about 80% of demand, up from 75% a day prior. For more on the latest in Ukraine, here's Mimi Montgomery with the Associated Press.
The Institute for the Study of War, a think tank that closely monitors developments in Ukraine, says Russian forces were digging in further east of the city of Kherson, from which they were recently expelled by Ukrainian forces. The attacks happened as utility crews continued to scramble to restore power, water, and heating after widespread strikes in recent weeks. And with persistent snowfall, including in the capital of Kyiv, analysts are predicting that wintry weather with frozen terrain and grueling fighting conditions could have an increasing impact on the direction of the conflict. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
Humanitarian groups have been on the ground in Ukraine since the war began, providing vital assistance to those in need. Recently, members from the non-governmental organization Save the Children went to Kherson. They report that families have been collecting water from puddles and they've been without power due to Russia's attacks on the country's civilian infrastructure. Georgia Tacey is the Ukraine program director to Save the Children. She recently spoke with VOA's Steve Miller about the challenges facing those living with water in Kherson and elsewhere as winter descends on Europe.
It's a very bleak and grim scene at the moment. You know, driving into Kherson, you can see that it was very much the forefront of a bitter battleground between the Ukraine and Russian forces. You have holes the size of swimming pools in the main highway leading up to the city that was caused by heavy artillery, completely decimated houses and gas stations and schools and shopping centres, completely razed to the ground as you enter the major region of Kherson. And then as you enter the more village community areas of the city, you can see that the people are very much still in shock. They're walking around. There's no fuel for cars, so people are all on foot carrying buckets of water that they are hoping to fill either at aid distribution points or anywhere they can find water from a river or small water source. You have queues, you know, 10,000 people deep trying to line up for the smallest of daily rations that were largely contributed by local organizations. You have people that are highly stressed, highly anxious. They have had no water, no electricity for over 2 or 3 weeks. And I guess they're just wondering what's next. And since I was there a few days ago, they have been under constant aerial bombardment. And so the anxiety and stress of families and children, and particularly those that have remained in the city, the people that had the financial resources left many, many months ago. So the people that remain in the city are people with limited means or limited support systems to go anywhere else. So we are really talking about the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. And so right now, they've got to really kind of think about the heartbreaking choice of do they stay and stay in their homelands and on their agricultural fields that are heavily contaminated with landmines and have no idea when electricity will come back and water, running water come back, or do they take the heartbreaking decision to get in the back of a truck and relocate somewhere else in the country with limited support and resources there as well.
You speak about the most vulnerable of the vulnerable and the people who did not have the means to leave Kherson and have been, you know, really under Russian occupation for almost 9 months. How many people, yeah, in your estimation are still there? Because part of the efforts of Save the Children was to distribute water and other means to help mitigate the horrific situation that you found. So how many people are there by your estimates, and can they all be helped?
Well, I think no one actually has the accurate level of data at the moment, but the pre-population was just under 300,000, and they think that has been reduced by at least half. And the short answer is, can we meet all those needs right now? We just simply can't, and I'm talking about the whole sector, let alone Save the Children. Just the sheer scale of destruction in terms of access to electricity and communications outside of Kherson, and the dangerous nature of actually getting in with all the contaminated landmines. It's incredibly difficult operating environment. We can't really assure the safety of everyone that goes in to help. So people are taking a huge amount of physical and personal risk to distribute aid. And so right now, there is not the amount of resources in Kherson to meet the immediate life-saving needs. Absolutely not.
That was Georgia Tacey with Save the Children in Ukraine. She was speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. The Biden administration is seeking $37 billion in aid for Ukraine in the coming weeks before the new Congress begins in January. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
It's winter in Ukraine as the 9-month fight against Russia's invasion continues. There has been widespread bipartisan support for aid to Ukraine in the U.S. Congress, but that may change. Some leaders of the Republican Party, who will hold a slim majority in the House when the new Congress begins in January, say they will closely scrutinize the Biden administration's proposed Ukraine aid packages. Congressman Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas, is the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He spoke on ABC's This Week.
We are going to provide more oversight, transparency, and accountability. We're not going to write a blank check.
Previous aid to Ukraine has been approved with overwhelming bipartisan support. The Biden administration is seeking $37 billion in emergency aid for Ukraine to make sure the nation and its military will have funding for the next few months. It includes $21.7 billion for military intelligence and other defense support, and $14.5 billion in humanitarian aid and for the Ukrainian government, according to the Biden administration. Jake Sullivan, the Biden administration's national security advisor, reiterated U.S. support for Ukraine during a visit to Ukraine earlier this month.
The United States is going to be with Ukraine for as long as it takes in this fight. There will be no wavering, no flagging, and no flinching in our support as we go forward.
While there is some opposition to supporting Ukraine in both parties, some Republicans have criticized the size of prior Ukraine aid packages and whether all the money has indeed gone to the struggling nation. They also question how well the Biden administration has tracked where Ukraine aid dollars have gone. Again, Congressman McCall.
We're going to do this in an accountable way with transparency to the American people. These are American taxpayer dollars going in. Does that diminish our will to help the Ukraine people fight? No, but we're going to do it in a responsible way.
Ukrainian officials said that utility crews were working to restore power over the weekend after Russia struck several areas in eastern and southern Ukraine. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
In other news, in Somalia, witnesses and the police say Al-Shabaab militants have carried out a complex attack on a hotel in a secure area not far from the presidential palace in Mogadishu. An unnamed official told VOA Somali service that the attack started with an explosion around 8.05 p.m., followed by armed gunmen storming the Villa Rosa, a hotel in Bondhir district, frequented by government officials and politicians. The militant group confirmed its fighters conducted a suicide infantry mission. And two countries were hit by landslides this weekend, Cameroon and Italy. At least 14 people were killed Sunday at a funeral service in Yaoundé, Cameroon, following the collapse of a 20-meter-high soil embankment at the base of a soccer pitch. Observers note that heavy rains this year likely weakened the ground. In Italy, rescue workers are continuing their search for victims of Saturday's landslide on the island of Isachiel, about 30 kilometers from Naples. At least two people have died in the incident. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. The United Nations and rights organizations around the world have begun the annual 16 Days of Action for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. A study by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime indicates that more than 5 women or girls are killed every hour by intimate partners or someone in their own family. To tell us more, here is James Shimanyola in Nairobi, Kenya.
Speaking from United Nations headquarters in New York, United States Sarah Hendricks, Director for Program, Policy and Intergovernmental Division, called UN Women, shed light on intentional killing of women or girls because of their gender.
Femicide rates remain at alarming levels, with more than 5 women or girls killed every hour by someone in their own family. And we know, of course, that behind every data point, behind every statistical point, is actually a lived life. It's actually a real woman or girl whose life has been very brutally and often very abruptly ended just because she is a woman.
Hendricks disclosed the details of the problem with a terse comment on the tough conditions under which women's rights organizations are operating.
Today's women's rights organizations are operating in an increasingly complex environment where they're facing threats to their very survival, where they're facing a significant shrinking space for civil society, and where there's a growing backlash against civil society and against women's rights in particular.
Delphine Shantz, head of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, summarized the contents of a report prepared by her office in New York.
The report presents global, regional, and sub-regional estimates of gender-related killings of women and girls in the private sphere in 2021, and I insist on the private sphere aspect of it. Globally, there is an estimated of about 81,000 women and girls who were victims of homicides in 2021. The majority of those homicides have been femicides, which means that there was a gender-related motivation behind these killings.
The UN report says of the 81,000 killed last year, nearly 60% were murdered by intimate partners or other family members. Asia recorded the largest number of gender-related killings overall compared to women and girls in Africa who were more at risk of being killed by domestic violence. In Africa, 2.5 females per 100,000 were killed compared to 1.4% in the Americas and below 1% in Asia and Europe. South Sudan, Africa's newest nation, takes the lead in high cases of violence against women and girls over the past 6 years, as Betty Murungi, prominent Kenyan lawyer and human rights defender, tells us.
Rape and crimes of sexual violence have been perpetrated on a staggering scale.
Murungi then turned to the Horn of Africa after more than 2 years of fighting between Ethiopia's federal forces and rebels belonging to Tigray People's Liberation Front.
Since the conflict began, the Ethiopian and Eritrean forces and regional militia targeting Tigrayan women and girls with violence and brutality. At times, the attackers used dehumanizing language that suggested an intent to destroy Tigrayan ethnicity.
The UN is calling for greater support and protection for survivors, including by police and judiciary, and an end to harmful masculine behavior and social norms. For VOA Africa News, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
Moroccan football fans are celebrating today after their team defeated Belgium 2-0. VOA journalist Khali Abdou is in Qatar and he spoke to fans such as this woman.
Yeah, as Moroccan, I'm very happy. So we're making sure that we're going to win the third game with Canada. Thank you.
And these men were celebrating.
So proud for our team. Inshallah, next match with Canada, we will be win. For going directly to the card 16. Inshallah, we will be do all the fans and teams all for inshallah going to the final. Inshallah, the final of the World Cup.
For a wrap-up on today's action, here's Khali reporting from Qatar.
It's been an exciting second round of group stage games in the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. The first game was Japan-Costa Rica. Costa Rica, who lost by 7 goals in their first game to Spain, needed to get something out of this game, and they certainly did that when they beat Japan by 1-0. Japan, who pulled off an upset when they beat Germany in their first game, lost this one, making their last game an all-important affair. In the second match of the day, Morocco pulled off quite the upset when they beat Belgium by 2-0, making them the second African nation to bag 3 points in this tournament. Belgium, one of the highly rated teams in the tournament, are facing an exit from the group stages if they fail to get 3 points in their final game against Croatia. In the third game, we saw Croatia emerge winners against the spirited Canada, who worked hard, scoring the first goal of the match, but ultimately falling to Croatia, who put 4 goals past them, ultimately crashing Canada out of the tournament. Finally, Spain and Germany contested an intense affair, where Spain scored first, setting up a tense scene in the stadium, with Germany facing an early exit from the group stages. But at the end, Germany equalized to make it 1-1, which is how the match ended. This makes the final round of games in Group E and F quite interesting indeed.
Sporty greetings. This is VOA's Sonny Young. brighten your day by tuning in the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. You can also follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and VOAAfrica.com. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the early morning hours of November 16th, the Artemis 1 moon rocket successfully launched from the Kennedy Space Center, starting the Orion spacecraft's journey to orbit the moon and marking a major step toward the goal of returning humans to the moon by 2025. NASA has named its lunar program Artemis after the twin sister of Apollo in a nod to the successful Apollo-era moon landings. The final Apollo mission to the moon occurred in December of 1972. We are all part of something incredibly special, the first launch of Artemis, the first step in returning our country to the moon and on to Mars. Artemis 1 launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson told the launch team after liftoff, "What you've done will inspire the next generation." The Artemis 1 launch was more than a decade in the making and faced repeated delays due to weather and technical issues. The Orion spacecraft will travel about 40,000 miles beyond the moon's far side, farther than any human-rated spacecraft, according to NASA. The Artemis 1 test flight is scheduled to culminate with Orion's splashdown in the Pacific Ocean on December 11th. The successful launch of Artemis 1 is the result of cooperative efforts to explore space, achieve a sustainable presence on the moon later this decade, and prepare to conduct a historic human mission to Mars, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement. Through the Artemis program, the United States is building the broadest and most diverse international human space exploration coalition in history, focused on making scientific and technological discoveries to advance our deep space efforts and return many benefits to our home planet, said Secretary Blinken. We look forward to continued work with international partners on future missions. With the Artemis Accords, the Department of State and NASA are bringing nations together through a common set of principles grounded in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty to guide civil space exploration and set the stage for peaceful, responsible, and productive cooperation in outer space. With the successful launch of the Artemis 1, NASA is one step closer to returning mankind to the moon. As the last astronaut to walk the moon's cratered surface, Eugene Cernan said, "We leave as we came, and, God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.